RPH is pleased to present the memoirs of Tilly Aston, Australia's blind poet, author and philanthropist. The story told of the many-faceted life of this talented woman is intriguing. The memoirs of Tilly Aston is published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. Episode 5.
I determined after that to fill my life with interests and ambitions, and with service for others where I could find a niche. By degrees, this all came to me, and I grew happy in watching the love of others. Throughout the years, I have had the young coming to me with their wonder stories, their tiffs and reconciliations, their weddings, babies and homes, and even the problems and triumphs of their children's education. I have found scope for my mother love without having held a child of my own. The lovely dreams of my youth have been realized, but not as some people would imagine. I have always had splendid men as friends. To me they have been kind and chivalrous, without a thought for my femininity, and they have served me and the cause I love with constancy and care. The needs of the blind of this state soon captured my interest and devotion, and the story of that work will be told later in this volume. There is yet one other sentimental adventure which I think worth mentioning, as it was of a totally different kind from those I have described. Early in this century, Dr. Zamenhof published his most beautiful international auxiliary language, Esperanto, and I became completely fascinated by its sweetness and possibilities. I mastered it from textbooks, and was not long before I had an extensive correspondence in all parts of the world. Among the letter friends was a man, resident in the United States of America, Usono, as we Esperantists call it, who was suffering from recent bereavement by the death of his wife and in need of mental diversion. He was a violinist and a very successful bandmaster. Sousa was his friend and often helped him with his arrangement of music for his bands. He was also a Spanish scholar and took a most intelligent interest in world affairs. We launched out on a regular interchange of letters, and this lasted for about 30 years until his death a year or so back. Gradually we became more intimate, as our respective modes of life were revealed to each other, and although we never met, his epistles developed into actual love letters of a very beautiful and innocent type, in themselves fine examples of that type of literary art. At first I laughed at them, and then my conscience began to stir, because I had not definitely cut them out. One day, a letter in the usual strain arrived when I had a niece visiting me, and I broke forth with a declaration that this sort of thing must stop. "What must stop, Auntie?" I explained. Her merriment over, it was rather irritating. "Why, Auntie," she cried, "don't you see what fun he's getting out of just writing those letters to you? It would break him up if you put an end to his literary effusions like that. You let him alone, if he wants to blow off on you. He is thousands of miles away, and it won't do you any harm. Why shouldn't the old fogies have a bit of fun, if they like a game like that?" Oh, these wise and experienced young women of this new generation! So the correspondence went on. I got my love letters, but there was neither proposal nor pledge, and I got his last message when I received the local paper from over there, giving an account of his very touching funeral. His children still write to me, and it is a pleasant contact, since I had grown to know them through their father, and to feel an extra friendly interest in their doings. After all these little confidences, I trust that no one will pity me for my mishaps in the game of love. Surely it is evident that I am a truly gay old maid, and an outstanding proof of the lines of Tennyson, where he says, "'Tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all." A voice, beloved. Over my soul there broke one day the tender tones of a voice that thrilled. 'Twas like the wind at break of day, and soft as the murmur of the bay, when other sounds were stilled. Never before had reached my ear such music laden with love and power. The tremulous sweetness drew me near and lighted the torch that still burns clear each dark and lonely hour. And, e'en through the years that come and go, the voice, beloved, is with me yet. Too dear for my soul to let go, no rapture as rich on earth I know, of glory, blessed youth's afterglow, unmarred by a vain regret. A little story has occurred to me, as possibly serving as a much shrewder explanation of the manner in which love's young dream forsook me quite early in life, so I append it as the concluding word on this theme. In the early years of the Association for the Advancement of the Blind, we discovered an aged man who had lost his sight and was very unhappy. He had been a compositor in the office of the Melbourne Punch, and loved reading above all things. So I persuaded him to learn to read by Braille, and helped a little by posting him a letter in that system every week. Naturally, Mr. Whittaker and I became very good friends, and the old gentleman never failed to sing my praise at all times and all places. One time, an unfounded rumour reached him that I was contemplating marriage. This was very upsetting to him, and he grumbled away to one and another, as I heard afterwards, although he said nothing to me about it. At last he opened up the subject with a mutual friend, and his final dictum was this: "We shall have to stop it. No one man must be allowed to monopolize her. She belongs to all of us blind people." And perhaps Mr. Whittaker was, as the issue has proved, quite right. Setting out in life. Having disposed of the lighter matters of the foregoing chapter, it is time to get back to more serious affairs. When I had recovered from the sickness and sorrow of my great failure, I recognized the necessity of finding a channel by which I could provide a livelihood for myself. This was not due to any family pressure, for Steve was anxious that I should share his home with my mother and just enjoy myself at his expense. Such a life had never been my ideal, and I had grown up in the conviction that for blind people, as for their sighted neighbors, independence was the best original equipment for citizenship. So I examined my own prospects, which were not very bright. I had hoped to teach in school, but the determined opposition to the blind teacher from the management of my old school made an appointment there unlikely. But I was open to engagement as tutor for any blind child whose parents were unwilling to send it to a charitable institution, and in due time I found such a pupil. This was Lillian, daughter of Mr. Charles Churchill, an Englishman who was in Melbourne with his family for a few years in connection with some business. Later they returned to London, but Lillian still writes to me after more than 40 years. In the meantime, I also advertised as a teacher of singing and music. In this line, I always had some work, but the fluctuations in this calling are well known to every mediocre practitioner, and I had my ups and downs as well as the rest of them. Still, it kept me in a meagre way, and as I was living with my own folk, there was never any shortage of the essentials for reasonable comfort. I helped with the household duties, and thus acquired a complete knowledge of housekeeping, from plain cooking to the chores at the washtub. There was plenty of fun in overcoming little problems, too. For instance, I sometimes overblued the white clothes, and suffered the disapproval of my superior officer. Later, I learned to measure so many gallons of water to a knob of blue, well mix, and thereafter all went well. In cooking, there were some chances, as thermometric stoves were unknown at that period, but I got on fairly well and could get a dinner or bake a tray of scones. During the 30 years since I made my own home, those duties have been relegated to my housekeepers, and I may have lost my skill through want of practice, yet I always find homemaking a topic of interest when I meet my women friends, to whom it is the chief topic. Next, I began to take trips in the street, unattended. At first, this gave much anxiety at home, until I declared my intention to rebel, and after that I went alone where I would. In those days, traffic was not so intense, and I roamed from one end of Melbourne to the other, out on country trips, and even as far as Sydney to visit my cousins. No fear assailed me then, and the public, the marvellous public, always lent a hand, as it still does when we need it. Another activity which absorbed a good deal of my time was the church. I had joined the Punt Road Paran Methodists while still at school, and now we all went there to worship. I joined the choir, took a girls' class in the Sunday school, and made friends among the people there. It was in this sphere that I fully grasped the truth that only in service does real development take place. I continued to take active part in religious work for 30 years, until the condition of my health broke that thread, since which time I have remained on the retired list, save for an occasional appearance as preacher at a woman's service, or as a speaker at friendly guild meetings, where I could tell a helpful story or do a little homely preaching on my own account. But I must get back to my early 20s. It may seem strange to the sighted reader that amid all this love at home, friendship at the church, pupils and other outlets, I should not be satisfied. I missed the blind world, and, with very few exceptions, found that other blind people were like myself, living apart from each other, often practical prisoners, because their families thought that food, clothing, and shelter should be the sum of life for the blind. Soon I began to feel that something must be done about it. But what could I do? I could not decide. I was just 20, inexperienced and poor, with my living to earn, and a sense of defeat still holding me down. I scarcely think I had any definite plans, though I knew the best was not being done for the blind. Further, I had been reading a little of what was going forward in other lands to help the sightless, and there were many streams of light flowing that had not burst forth on this side of the world. With my mind thus full of longings to help, I taught music, went on a concert tour in Tasmania, and came home again, convinced that I was not a trooper at heart, and must have a settled place in which to dwell. Then my first call came, the story of which is given in my next chapter. Another of Tilly's poems, Defeat, originally published in Singable Songs. When circumstance, that monster unrelenting, shall stand with club upraised, is man to bow, nor think of circumventing, nor lift a hand, the deadly blow preventing, like one by terror dazed? The heart cries, never! Let him go down fighting, or let him subtle grow. 'Tis his to dodge, recoil, the danger slighting, or cunningly the onset fierce inviting, to thrust aside the blow. But let the tyrant with his fears defeat you, a shattered thing you lie. He'll never pass that way, but he will greet you with boast insulting. How he once did beat you, till even hope will die. Origin of the Braille Library in 1894. As will have been learned from a previous record, I had aimed at winning an arts degree at the Melbourne University. For a year or two, I had battled on with my studies, getting safely through the first year of my course, and some odd examinations towards the next stage. But the difficulties encountered were tremendous, the chief one being the absence of textbooks in Braille. Of course, in some subjects these could be read aloud, such as logic, philosophy, and English literature. But I doubt if any student could master a complete course in mathematics and languages without the text in full before him. So I struggled on, with any odd friend to dictate while I copied, and it may be imagined what a hopeless task I had undertaken. I failed to get the coveted BA degree, and had to swallow my disappointment as best I could. At that time, I was intimate with a family named Blakely, in which was a blind brother, David, a schoolmate of mine. One day, when I was unburdening my sorrows to Mary, his sister, and lamenting my special handicaps about textbooks, she said, "What a pity some of us didn't know in time. We could have learnt Braille and transcribed some of the books for you." I then told her that in England, libraries for the blind were being formed of hand-copied volumes written by devoted Braille transcribers. Printing for the blind was, and still is, very costly, so that only very popular or necessary books could be printed. Hence, the handmade production was the one means of getting a library together. I wonder if there would be any chance of starting such a movement in Melbourne, and Miss Blakely offered to help me if a way could be found. The first opening came when she was invited to read a paper at the monthly meeting of the Stenographers' Association. I had all the material required, the story of Louis Braille, the inventor of the system, particulars of the movement to build up libraries of handwritten books in Britain, and naturally, I was myself an expert in Braille. So we got together and prepared the paper, and Miss Blakely read it at the meeting while I was present to give a demonstration. In the audience was Mrs. D. Harrison, wife of the confidential clerk in the legal firm in which Miss Blakely also served as stenographer. Mrs. Harrison at once grew deeply interested in the idea and offered to learn Braille and to copy books. She invited Miss Blakely and myself to visit her, and we were soon busy with lessons. I am not absolutely certain about the first book completed, but I think it was The Cricket on the Hearth. At any rate, it was one of the shorter works of Dickens, and others followed very quickly. Mr. and Mrs. Harrison opened their home at 2 Charlotte Place, St. Kilda, to the work, and it was arranged that I should go there for the day, each Wednesday, to meet the pupils and correct their exercises. This work I continued for a considerable time, and the band of workers grew. All persons did not leave the same clear impress on the memory, but I recall from those days Miss Mary Forrest, Mrs. Rodder, and Miss Prentice, who did a good deal of copying, and Messrs. Molloy, Mitchell, Legault, and our beloved social president of a few years ago, Mr. W. H. McLennan, all of whom, with Mr. W. R. Church, helped with the administration or in the raising of money. One of the first whose exercises I corrected was Miss Blythe, who is still doing a bit at writing, although over 90. These and others would come to the house of Mrs. Harrison, bringing work which, when fit to be bound, I prepared for new volumes. Thither also came the first blind readers, as a few books were ready for lending. Among them were Will Hall, Charlie Taylor, Joe Walker, Dick Prismal, Tom Marks, and Dave and Janie Robertson. These blind folk would come along every Wednesday evening, and the dry jokes of Dave Blakely would add to the social nature of the gatherings, while volumes were sorted out and parcelled up, and blind world gossip exchanged. But Braille books are very bulky, and it soon became evident that another home must be provided for the collection, and also money to meet the heavy cost of paper and binding. The Still Young Australian Natives Association was approached, and its council took up the matter with enthusiasm. The various branches organised meetings in the city and suburbs, gaining for the movement both publicity and funds. At these gatherings, I took part as a demonstrator and singer. Coming in contact with most of the leading musical artists of the time, I especially recall the kindly charm of Rosina Palmer, the rather stately manners of Arms Beaumont, never, I may say, cold or repellent. There was Maggie Sterling, Ada Crossley, Mr. G, good old Will Elder, with his humorous recital so dear to us all. How I enjoyed those fine performers as they gave to our rising library this magnificent gift of their talents. Thus we got ourselves known, and the number of volumes increased. I cannot omit mention of another friend we made at this time, Mr. Thomas Luxton, father of the families now holding distinction amongst us. He was mayor of Paran, and we never asked for any help he could give without receiving it immediately. In due time, we were able to rent a large room in the block, Collins Street, Melbourne, in which all business of an executive kind was done, and from whence circulated the books to a fast-growing list of readers all over the state of Victoria. Mrs. Harrison was still honorary secretary, a post which she held till her death 18 years after the founding of the library. The later history of this movement is well known, and I presume there are plenty of records from which to draw information. Soon after the removal of the work to the city, circumstances caused a break in my connection with the Association of Braille Writers, and since then I have had no official link with it, but unofficially I have always been available when there was a little job I could do. One outstanding occasion of this kind I recall with great satisfaction. For a long time, the Edward Wilson trustees had been considering whether they would give us a library building for ourselves, which could house the books and office and afford a social centre for the readers. Some pressure to dissuade them from this course had been put forward by the management of the Royal Victorian Institute for the Blind, and it was the opinion of that body that this special department of work for the blind should pass into their hands. A conference with the trustees was ultimately arranged at the home of Mr. Murray Smith, and I was there to speak on behalf of the readers. I pleaded for our recreation to be kept right away from the atmosphere of our work. How we had found in the library a happy personal touch that could not be attained in an institution controlling both education and the daily bread question for so many of us. Well, we got our way, and I think my intercession had much to do with it. The fine building in Commercial Road, South Yarra, was the result, and on the day of the opening I had the honour to receive the key from the late Sir George Fairbairn, who was one of the Wilson trustees at the time, and to whom I gave the assurance that it would never be used to lock out any of the blind. It just remains for me to say about this subject one very pleasant thing, that sympathetic personal touch which has made the relations of readers and staff of the library so kindly and constant, right on through the period of Miss Millicent Ritchie, MBE, and Miss Minnie Crabb, has never waned. And to one who has experienced many phases of philanthropic and charitable work, the prayer arises in my heart that it may ever be thus, and that the true humanitarian may always hold the reins in this special sphere, remembering that the blind, though handicapped in body, are not handicapped in spirit. This chapter was written during the week preceding the Great Jubilee Gathering at the Library, 25th of March, 1944. On that evening, I delivered a speech which was an abridgment of this chapter. Explanatory. Before proceeding to give the details of the next important activity of my younger days, it seems advisable to insert here a brief explanation of the blind world situation at the time in this part of the world. In 1866, some public-spirited citizens of Paran had felt the need of an institution for the blind, so it was founded in that year and was known as the Asylum and School for the Blind, a title which it retained until the early 90s. Recalling the scope of the institution when I entered it for education in 1882, I find that it consisted of a school for the children in which the curriculum was embryonic but slowly improving. No inmate was received there after school age, so that a person losing his vision from 16 years and upwards was not able to benefit by the instruction given. One or two exceptions may have occurred, but the limit of age was the general and constantly practiced rule. As the children came out of the schoolroom, training was begun for a life program. Where there was musical ability, it was developed, and some fine teachers and church organists were turned out. Some of the pupils, of course, returned to their families to take a share in the work of the home or assist in other common interests. The rest stayed on, some to learn the trades of mat-making, brush and broom work, and heavier basketry, and generally, when trained, these were employed in the institution workshops. They lived in, together, with a few unemployable cases, so that altogether about 200 of our 1,000 blind were under the care of this asylum and school. Such a policy was not altogether out of keeping with the times. Workers received a nominal gratuity in money and free board and lodging. Then, as numbers increased, it was found advisable to make journeymen of the best workers, and they were boarded with their own people or in other suitable homes nearby. This order continued till about 1892, when it was decided to change the policy. The name of the institution had already been altered to the Royal Victorian Institute for the Blind, and it was no longer an asylum, but a school, from which the pupils graduated to musical studies or into the workshops. It would have been easy at that time to liberalise the policy, so as to admit the young adult blind to enter for training and employment, but it was not done, and out of this narrow view of its obligations, the determination to hold to the out-of-date programme came much suffering to those for whom the organisation existed. This sorely needed change did not take place until some years after the founding of the Association for the Advancement of the Blind. At that time, I went to the government on a deputation to ask financial aid for our blind home at Brighton Beach. And at the Treasury, I found Mr. W. A. Watt, an old friend of mine. He had married, as his first wife, a dear girl I had known, but after her death, we had not been in contact for each other. Perhaps he was more inclined to listen to me on account of this former acquaintance, but he did not agree to help us from the public funds. I may say here that throughout the 49 years of the growing activities of my Brotherhood of the Blind, not one penny of government money has aided us in financing the work. Mr. Watt was astonished, however, at the limitations of the work being done at the old institution, and he was for forcing their hands in the matter. I have a faint idea that there were some warm passages between the management and the state treasurer, although I know little about it, save that there was actually a slight change of heart, and by degrees a few young adults were rescued from enforced mendicancy, which had been the only shameful means of living left to many heretofore. These were placed in the workshops, but still the vast majority of the sightless remained unhelped, uncomforted, unless their fellow blind could reach them. Most of them had no social life, a few friends, practically no encouragement to help themselves, and those facts should explain the motives which induced me to rouse my fellow blind and form them into my brotherhood. The Association for the Advancement of the Blind, which has put forth through half a century its strenuous efforts to improve the status of our group and to offer intercourse, happiness, and hope to so many who were missing them all.
And that brings us to the end of episode 5 of The Memoirs of Tilly Aston, published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. This series was produced in the studios of 3RPH Melbourne for the RPH Network.